Can I don't know, I wasn't looking over here very well, but do you guys know, like, sort of, who had questions that were first?
Well, I want to thank you for your excellent presentation, and it's nice to see you again. I think fondly of our press conference together in 2004, condemning Bush's visit in Halifax. So, welcome back to Halifax. I just want to appeal to you, John, when you're talking about Canada, Canadian foreign policy, to include the Canada First Defense Strategy, because most Canadians aren't aware of it, haven't read it, and it's the blueprint for Canada's military industrial academic complex. You know, it came out in 2008, and it's going to commit $490 billion of our tax dollars to greater urban warfare, counterinsurgency, and greater interoperability with the United States. And the Canadians really need to oppose this. The other thing is that there's many years, there's evidence of many years that the United States has been funding civil society groups in Egypt through the National Endowment Fund for Democracy or whatever. And then my question is, what's next for you? What's next for you?
Right now I'm living in the West Bank. It's going really well. I'm fortunate to be on sort of on the ground floor of the of Al Jazeera. And you know, when the things that my mother used to freak out about have been sort of replaced, and my work is valued and fits into some of the work that Al Jazeera is doing. I don't think Al Jazeera is a panacea or anything like that, and there's a lot of structural critiques of it to be had. I won't give too many of them because as I just said, I'm very fortunate to be on the ground floor of that. So I think I'm going to stick with that for now. I sort of, I think as I get older, I sort of look at, you know, what you're going to do when you have a family, and during the Intifada, my parents and trusted friends and advisors used to caution me on what would happen if I were to get injured or something, God forbid. So there definitely is a birdie whispering to go back to school and try to get some sort of. But no, I think as it is right now, this is the work I'm going to do, and I have done. I think since we last saw each other, I don't think I've done anything that would surprise you, or I think it's been very consistent since. Since the late '90s, and I'm so far so good. I like living in Palestine. The Palestinians are very hospitable, and it's been great. I mean hospitable in the truest sense, not as some sort of fetish type.
I can hear the dear mother. Chief correspondent of the CBC, Mr. McDonald,
yeah.
He lived almost his life in Gaza Strip.
Yeah.
So when you're talking, I hear Neil McDonald. He loves Gaza. He loves Gaza's people.
Yeah.
He loved them.
Yeah, and I think he's one of the few, he's a principal, serious. I mean, probably one of the best journalists in Canada, and I see that as being a continuity. It's somebody who thinks that way and who has the sort of backbone that he does, that he felt that way, and I think it's also worth noting that he was blacklisted by the Israelis and was unable to work anymore in Palestine because. It's important for correspondents to have contacts with government officials so that you can get word. And the Israelis had blacklisted him and would never speak to him, so they had to reposition him. I'm gonna hammer these really quickly. I answered too long, I know.
Right. You're quite sympathetic to the Hamas, and you sort of decried the Israeli military attacking its leaders and killing its leaders. Just a factual question. Does the Hamas have a mandate that calls for the removal of all Jews from Israel?
No, I mean, if you look most recently, you have, in fact, Hamas is being critiqued within the Palestinian milieu for its acceptance of a two-state solution. They've said that since they were elected. And I think for a lot of Palestinians who view all of historical Palestine as their homeland, the move of Hamas into supporting a two-state solution is something that people are very critical of in Palestine. For example, a two-state solution would mean that Dr. Zaid would be no longer would either have to choose to give up his heritage in his destroyed village, for example, or any of the other millions of people who have that. A two-state solution renounces that right. It renounces the right of his family members who are in camps and within walking distance of their previous homes. So there's a controversial element of a two-state solution within the Palestinian political milieu too. And I think Hamas's acceptance of that puts them in a bit of a situation to that, because less than half of Palestinians live in Palestine. So a two-state solution renounces that heritage, that homeland, that legal right that they have to return or to be compensated for that loss. I don't think I'm sympathetic to Hamas necessarily. I think these are, if you want a personal attribute, politically I'm an anarchist. I have no sympathy whatsoever for government in the first place, but an Islamic government in the next vein, I don't think that that's a benefit. I think Hamas was elected, that Hamas was elected says more about Fatah than it does, I think, about Hamas. But there, when you live there, you realize that there's a lot of support for Hamas. There's a lot of significant element that has respect in the community. In fact, if you look at the election, Hamas won the election. There's two tickets in Palestine. There's a national ticket, and each political party lists its national leaders. And then half of the seats in parliament are what we would call municipal votes, like on a village level. So the national leaders, so Fatah versus Hamas on a national level, is very close. I think it was like 47% to 42% kind of thing. But on the direct democracy level, on the village level, Hamas swept, both in the Jerusalem is considered sort of the cosmopolitan aspect of the Palestinian civil society, and something like Jabalia or Gaza City, or the camps around Gaza are considered the sort of more, populist elements. They swept. They swept in Jerusalem. They swept in the north and the south. So, I think you can't really ignore that, and you can't ignore that if you were to look up Haniyeh. Ismail Haniyeh was not a Hamas leader. He was not part of the leadership command. That's why he wasn't assassinated before he became prime minister. He was never part of the political command structure. So if you were to search his statements on the conflict, they're all new. And you won't find anything from Haniyeh but acceptance for a two-state solution. So it's not like
you would divorce the contemporary sort of statements that Hamas makes from their historical ideology?
Well, are you referring to the charter? Yeah, so the charter, the thing that's important to understand about Hamas is that Hamas is an acronym for the Islamic Movement, which is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, which was a social political project that created mosques and schools, and Hamas is the Islamic Resistance Movement. And so basically Hamas formed as a counter to the formation of Islamic Jihad, which was the Islamist elements within Palestinian society saying enough of this institutional building, enough mosque building, enough community centers, let's fight back. And so when the first Intifada started, spontaneously, people weren't expecting it, basically Hamas the Brotherhood formed this political action wing called Hamas, and the charter, the charter was written as a telephone pole communique to say, this is who we are. It was written in one day and sent out, and it's an absolutely absurd document if people want to read it. It's an idiotic document. And why Hamas, the second day, didn't just say, actually, we renounce that charter and move on, is probably more of a anthropological, psychological study of Hamas than it is of anything else, because it's an idiotic document that talks about the role of the Lions Clubs it's a foolish document. So there's no record of operational support for that. And nobody's stupid enough to think that every Zionist colonizer is going to go somewhere else. They're there, the state exists. If you were to travel there, you would look at the conflict as absurd. They've got railroads, they've got airports, they've got building constantly. cranes everywhere. You know, nobody thinks Israel is going to go away. So whatever, you know, whatever religious statements or historical statements are made by Hamas are rhetoric. I mean, they're not practice, and that's what Hania says. Hania says, you know, the state exists clearly. We don't need to, you know, Canada doesn't recognize Mexico or whatnot. So Hania says, you know, the state exists. Let's move past that narrative.
These two, and then we left.
I think Dr. Zaid had his hand up.
Well, I just wanted to make a comment.
Okay.
First of all, I would say Mr. Harper contributed tremendously towards the starvation and malnutrition produced in Gaza by cutting the UNRWA, United Nations Relief and Work Agency, money, which is an extraordinary act for a government that pretends to be liberal and all that sort of stuff. He also, of course, the war in Lebanon and the war in Gaza was described as self-defense. But I wanted to make a comment at a professional level about Dov Weisglass's statement about the formaldehyde. Formaldehyde destroys the elements of life and the structure, but maintains the framework. And that is exactly what it did. What formaldehyde does, it maintains the appearance of a structure, but destroys all elements of life in it. And that's what they meant by what they're doing in Gaza. Keep the appearance of the strongest basic life, whatever it is.
That's why we keep doctors in the movement as well.
I know our time is up and I've been hurrying you along. However, I was kind of hoping you'd say something about the BDS movement.
Okay.
Maybe just a short comment.
You did, you both did, and you said you were going to bring that up. I think the BDS thing, one of the most significant elements of the BDS movement, despite the like historical analogies that it's successful and it works, and that's one of the reasons why the Israelis have freaked out about this BDS idea.
What is BDS?
The boycott, divestment, sanctions. Okay, so there's three levels. There's a boycott level, which is a consumer level, individual level of interacting, so boycott. Divestment is sort of an institutional level, universities and pension plans and whatnot, removing their funding. And then sanctions is the government level. The idea that you push from the B through the D to the S in isolating, and that's the sort of model of apartheid South Africa. There has been a significant move towards the boycott, divestment, sanctions as a sort of, I think, as an outcrop of the certain elements within the Palestinian political milieu saying that the armed struggle had hit a dead end. We need a new way to diplomatically interact with the conflict, and it gave rise to this boycott, which Dr. Zaid could tell us. The boycott of for Palestinians is, of course, the like core of the Palestinian movement towards Israel has been boycotts, right? Since day one, I mean, since the 1920s, it's been boycott. What this is an international element to this movement. And I think that the benefits and the movement benefits of a boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign is that it allows each community, each political community, to operate sort of in concentric circles, growing out, where you're interacting in your own political milieu. So in Halifax, or Nova Scotia, in Canada, in North America, you can view it like this. And so instead of saying, debating within our movements, do we support a two-state solution? Do we support a one-state solution? What do we think about the refugees? What do we think? Instead of having all these divisive debates, which don't, I mean, it doesn't matter what Halifax thinks about the two-state solution, frankly. But we spend so much time in our groups debating these kind of things. Well, what BDS does is lets us work within whatever our logical milieu is. So, for example, in France, it's against Veolia, who is sort of the Bombardier of France, which is building this train that is going to link the settlements so that the Jews can go from the north to the south without having to drive through Palestinian areas. And so in France, there was a campaign against Veolia. At various universities, I would recommend Dalhousie being one of those universities to look into a divestment campaign, which companies are being funded by Canadians that maybe don't intend to. It's not about like looking at your portfolio and going, I I invest in Bombardier. Usually it's these mutual funds, these kind of nebulous, you know, large-scale coupled investments that people, so a divestment campaign might withdraw funding for certain Israeli companies and corporations on a divestment level. The idea that you then pressure your government all the way up to the sanctions level so that there's a formal diplomatic sanctions campaign. And the elders amongst us, I mean that in the truest political sense, will remember the anti-apartheid movement worked that way. For many, many years, in fact decades, right, Canada obstructed the sanctions level of the boycott divestment aspect until, what, the late 80s or whatever it was, when Brian Mulroney, who was an obstacle to sanctions and was a supporter of South Africa for his entire political career, was forced to invoke sanctions. And then, I remember as a school kid, Nelson Mandela came and spoke, you know, from the CIA arrested terrorist who would refuse to renounce armed struggle and refused, by the way, to recognize the Afrikaner regime in the Israel-Palestine conflict. He refused to renounce armed struggle and refused to recognize the Afrikaner regime right until the end of his days, and still hasn't. He spoke at SkyDome. And we all went and sat on the, you know, on the SkyDome as sixth graders or whatever, and here's Mandela, this guy who is the number one terrorist, the guy, I mean, the conservatives still